Good morning, everyone. The focus of this lead-off panel for today's symposium is the Due Process Clause, its original meaning, and possible future applications. In particular, our panelists will address the doctrine known to us today as substantive due process. It's a contentious doctrine, as we've seen just this week in an intra-party Republican power struggle over a prominent judicial nominee. And of course, some of the Supreme Court's most controversial cases rest on substantive due process, or at least one strand of the doctrine. Our panelists today will address whether and how the doctrine of substantive due process is tethered to the original meaning of the Due Process Clause. I anticipate that they will also touch on the standard objection to the doctrine, namely, that the very idea of substantive due process is a contradiction in terms, that the term process in the Due Process Clause means procedure, or more specifically, the legal procedures that the executive branch and the courts must observe before depriving a person of life, liberty, or property. If this objection is correct, then the clause does not restrict the substance of legislative enactments. But, of course, the Supreme Court does not read the Due Process Clause as limited to procedures. On the other hand, neither does the Court read the Due Process Clause to require meaningful judicial scrutiny of all legislative enactments. The doctrine lies somewhere in between. The leaders of the Federalist Society chapter here at the University of Virginia have assembled a very distinguished panel of experts to enlighten us on this debate, and it's my honor this morning to introduce them. Leading us off this morning is your own Professor John Harrison. As you know, Professor Harrison teaches and writes in constitutional law, constitutional history, federal courts, and legislation, among other courses and academic interests. He joined the law faculty here at the University of Virginia after a decade of work in important posts in the U.S. Department of Justice, including as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel. He earned his bachelor's degree here at the University of Virginia and his law degree at Yale, and he clerked for Judge Robert Bork of the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Next up this morning will be Professor Randy Barnett of the Georgetown University Law Center, where he writes and teaches on constitutional law and contracts and directs the Georgetown Center for the Constitution. Professor Barnett's influential books include Restoring the Lost Constitution, The Presumption of Liberty, and most recently, Our Republican Constitution, Securing the Liberty and Sovereignty of We the People. His scholarship has been recognized with the Guggenheim Fellowship in Constitutional Studies and by the Bradley Foundation, Milwaukee's own, where I hail from, with its Bradley Prize. Professor Barnett argued the Gonzalez versus Raich case in the Supreme Court, that was the medical marijuana case, and had a central role in NFIB versus Sebelius, the challenge to the individual health insurance mandate in the Affordable Care Act. Professor Barnett earned his undergraduate degree at Northwestern University and his law degree at Harvard. Third in line this morning is Scott Ballinger, partner in the Supreme Court and Appellate Practice Group at the firm of Latham & Watkins in Washington, D.C. And I understand he also teaches here at Virginia as an adjunct professor. In his capacity in his law practice, he has had a leading role in many significant constitutional cases in appellate courts around the country and has argued two cases in the United States Supreme Court. He has also worked in the Antitrust Division in the Department of Justice. Mr. Ballinger earned both his bachelor's degree and his law degree right here at Virginia. And finally this morning, we'll hear from Virginia's own Professor Julia Mahoney. She joined the faculty here in 1999 and teaches courses in constitutional law, property, and government finance, among others. Before coming to Virginia, she practiced law at the Wachtell firm in New York City. She is a graduate of Barnard College and the Yale Law School. With that, I will turn it over to Professor Harrison.
Judge, do you want us to speak from here? Or?
Yes, no,
okay.
That's fine.
That's good. All right. Thank you. The first thing I should say is that what I'm going to say, this is directed specifically to any first-year law students in the room. This should come with a warning. Do not take anything I am about to say into your con law exam. There's a great story along those lines that involves my constitutional law teacher and my constitutional law teacher, but the story is too long, so it won't fit in the margin. I'll just allude to it. Instead, I will use the time I just saved to say something to set the stage about the relationship between the original meaning of the 14th Amendment, we're going to be talking specifically about the Due Process Clause, and the doctrine of the courts, especially the Supreme Court of the United States. In one of its earlier iterations, this panel was going to be about the 14th Amendment generally, and it was narrowed down to due process, but this is about the 14th Amendment generally. As most of you know, one of the controversies in the Supreme Court these days is what to do about partisan gerrymandering and whether the Equal Protection Clause puts any limitations on partisan gerrymandering. Well, from the standpoint of the original meaning of the text, there is a straightforward answer to that. The straightforward answer is no. And the reason the straightforward answer is no is because Section 1 of the 14th Amendment is categorically limited. It applies only to some legal interests and not to others, and the legal interests it does apply to don't include political rights. It applies to the privileges or immunities of citizens. Those mean civil rights, not political rights, civil rights like property and contract, but not voting, for example. And it applies to the protection of the laws, but the protection of the laws is substantially narrower even than civil rights. The protection of the laws means the remedial processes of government, the means by which rights are protected rather than the substance of rights. So neither of those includes political rights. What I just said has nothing to do with the doctrine of the Supreme Court. It was just about the text of the 14th Amendment. So as I say, as I'm talking about the text of the 14th Amendment and its original meaning, don't take that into your con law exam. All right. Now, the Due Process Clause and substantive due process. A deeply anachronistic piece of terminology, at least. Whether the concept is anachronistic is another question, but the terminology is highly anachronistic. Talking about substantive due process arose at the beginning of the 20th century. The first time the Supreme Court of the United States used that terminology was sometime in the 1950s. So don't even think about the terminology, but I am going to talk about the issues. I'm going to talk about the text of the 14th Amendment and add its historical context. Its historical context very much includes developments, something else that many contemporary American lawyers aren't familiar with, but that are important in understanding the 14th Amendment, developments during the first half of the 19th century. When American courts, mainly state courts, but occasionally the federal courts, including the Supreme Court of the United States, developed what today is sometimes called the doctrine of vested rights due process. The doctrine of vested rights was the fundamental doctrine of American constitutional law for 150 years. The doctrine of vested rights was legislatures may not, through direct legislative action, deprive people of vested rights of property. Classic way of expressing that was to say legislatures may not take the property of A and give it to B. There's a substantial body of case law in the first half of the 19th century that attributed that principle, the basic doctrine of American constitutional law, to due process clauses, not of the Fifth Amendment, which didn't apply to the states, but similar provisions in state constitutions. And there are a few Supreme Court of the United States cases along those lines involving the Fifth Amendment. So the constraint that I'm going to accept in understanding the original meaning of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment is its background included this practice by American courts, vested rights due process. What does that tell us about, given the text itself, about whether it generates anything like what is called today substantive due process? I'm going to say no. I'm going to say the text reiterates principles of separation of powers and the rule of law, and that there's an interesting story about the text's connection to the doctrine of vested rights that tells us something about not only how courts work, but how different pieces of the Constitution interact with other legal principles. I'm going to start with the text, which says no one shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And to understand that, first ask the question, well, what is a deprivation of life, liberty, or property with due process of law? Sort of the opposite of what the text says is impermissible. And the classic answer now, and the classic answer at the time of the 14th Amendment, was a deprivation of life, liberty, or property with due process of law was done by a court operating the way courts operate, which is to say, applying the existing primary and remedial law and, if appropriate, changing the legal rights, that's deprivation of life, liberty, or property, changing the legal rights of the parties before them. So, for example, a sentence of confinement or a fine would be a deprivation of liberty or property, an adverse change in legal rights pursuant to the existing primary and remedial law, using the methods of operation that the courts use, that is to say, notice and hearing, adversarial proceedings. Those were deprivations with due process. How does that apply to the possibility that there would be, how does that apply to the possibility that the due process clause would apply to the legislature? Well, what does due process mean? I think there are two real possibilities. One is due process just means the particular part of the government involved doing things the way the law requires that government, that part of the government to operate. The way the law requires legislatures to operate is to do what the legislatures do and exercise legislative power pursuant to the procedures. Article 1, Section 7 of the Federal Constitution sets out the procedures by which Congress makes law. By one possibility is that's what due process of law means when it applies to the legislature. Now that, of course, would just reiterate the rule of law. It would say legislatures have to do what they do the way they do it. Notice that would not have any what we would call today substantive content for the due process clause. The other understanding of due process of law, and the one that was mainly embraced in those antebellum cases, the first half of the 19th century cases that I mentioned a few moments ago, was that due process of law meant specifically judicial process, the way of working that the courts use, what I also described a moment ago, that is applying the existing primary and remedial law through an adversary proceeding. That then raises a problem. Legislatures don't work that way. Legislatures don't apply existing law. Legislatures make law. If that is what due process means, then legislatures are categorically forbidden from depriving anybody of life, liberty, or property. It's not they have to proceed reasonably. It's not that they have to balance this against that. No, they can't do it according to this reading of what due process is, which means the crucial question then becomes, well, what's a deprivation? Because legislatures are categorically forbidden to impose a deprivation. And the difficulty arises that there are things legislatures do that are unquestionably legitimate exercises of legislative power that have the same legal effects as some of the things that the courts do. For example, when a legislature imposes a tax, the legislature creates a new obligation to pay money. When a court imposes a fine, the court imposes a new obligation to pay money. Can it be that the concept of deprivation for legislatures is the same as the concept of deprivation for courts, so that legislatures are substantially disabled from doing a lot of things that legislatures ordinarily do? The answer is no. The concept of deprivation for legislatures must be a little, well, I don't want to say it's a little bit different. What I'm going to say instead is this. The concept of deprivation does not include legitimate exercises of the legislative power. The concept of deprivation that's at work in the 14th Amendment and in due process clauses in state constitutions in the Fifth Amendment is the one that matches the concept of due process that the courts use. Deprivations categorically exclude legitimate exercises of the legislative power. A way to express that, common way to express that in the first half of the 19th century, all rights, life, liberty, or property included, are held subject to legitimate exercises of the legislative power. Meaning that this inquiry has now redirected us to the question, well, what are legitimate exercises of the legislative power? And remember, I said, I'm going to try to explain not only what the text means, but how the people in the early part of the 19th century could think that the text generates the principle of vested rights due process. And the short answer is, and people said this in the first half of the 19th century, of course, legislative power can't be used to deprive people of vested rights. There are inherent limits on legislative power and the legislative power granted to American legislatures. Justice Story said that, sitting on circuit. He said that about a state that didn't even have a due process clause, Rhode Island, which didn't even have a written constitution at the time, at least not one as we would understand it, but did have a legislature with legislative power. Story believed that legislative power was intrinsically limited. It's an interesting question whether to understand that as saying, well, there's something built into legislative power as a matter of separation of powers, or what I think is actually the more useful explanation of the way people at the time thought, which was there's an independent principle that vested rights, especially vested rights of property, are immune from alteration by the government. Now, if that's true, if there's an independent principle of vested rights, which people in the 19th century American lawyers and judges almost universally believed, if that's true, well, what's the role of the Due Process Clause? Why would they say, well, it's the Due Process Clause, state law analogs that have something to do with the principle of vested rights, the principle that the legislature can't take the property of A and give it to B? And the answer is the Due Process Clause did have a role to play. The Due Process Clause reiterated the principle of separation of powers. The Due Process Clause meant that something the courts couldn't do was claim to be the legislature. They couldn't deprive, the legislatures couldn't claim to be the courts. That is to say, legislatures could not say, we can do the kind of deprivation that a court could do. The Due Process Clause blocked that, left legislatures with legislative power, which was either intrinsically limited or subject to an external limitation arising from a freestanding principle of vested rights. That way, the Due Process Clause is doing something. It is reiterating the principle of separation of powers and doing something that, when you think about it in the times, is actually fairly important. One important question was, were American legislatures anything like Parliament? Because Parliament was not just a legislature. Parliament was also the highest court. Parliament could exercise all kinds of power, not just legislative power. It's a fundamental principle of American separation of powers that American legislatures aren't like that. They have only legislative power, just as the president, just as governors, have only executive power. They're not the king. They don't have the sovereignty that the king had. And there's an analogous argument having to do with executives and the difference between American executives and the sovereign king of Great Britain that also works through the due process clauses. That's going to go in the margin, too. That won't fit either in the time I have. So once again, I'll just mention it. I'm focusing mainly, because that's what the doctrine was mainly about in the first half of the 19th century, on the legislature. And the due process clauses did stand for the principle, yes, legislatures are legislatures. They're not courts. They can't do the kind of thing courts can do. And then pointed over to the principles governing the exercise of legislative power. The 14th Amendment, that is to say, and due process clause generally, when it came to the limitations on legislative power, those that generated the principle of vested rights, referred to but did not themselves contain principles of separation of powers. That's why I say the 14th Amendment reiterates separation of powers. It also, as applies to the executive, this is the part I don't have time to get into, reiterates the principle of the rule of law, but it reiterates and underlines those and does not by itself supply it. So the short answer is, in 21st century or later 20th century terms, no, it does not generate what we would today call substantive due process. But for all of these reasons that require some careful inquiry both into the text and into the historical circumstances surrounding it. So the bottom line, it's about separation of powers. It's about the rule of law.
Wonderful. Thanks to UVA Law Federal Society for having me here, for accommodating my schedule. I had a late Hoyas game last night I had to go to, and I have got to get back to D.C. to teach my Con Law 1 class this evening, so I'm squeezing this in. I won't be able to see the whole program, which disappoints me, because it really, really is a truly excellent program that I really wish I could be here for every minute of. My comments today on due process of law are going to somewhat pick up where John leaves off. You're going to see a somewhat different valence between him and me, but actually there's a considerable overlap in our views. I would tend to agree with everything he said and just say, yeah, but there's more. So that's one way to interpret what I'm going to say versus what John just said. The idea that the due process of law requires judges to examine the substance of legislation to determine whether it is constitutional today is called substantive due process. That label was originally formulated to show the absurdity of the idea. John's right, it was formulated in the 20th century. This is not an old doctrine. John Hart Ely said it was a concept like green pastel redness. The contradictory concept of substantive due process is then contrasted with the redundancy of procedural due process, which you might say is process due process. While the earliest critics of substantive due process were progressives, in recent years, the concept has been most vociferously denounced by conservatives. In my remarks this morning, I will explain first why the original meaning of the due process of law protected by the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments requires an inquiry into the substance of legislation. In particular, it requires that no person be deprived of life, liberty, or property except pursuant to a valid law that was within the power of the legislature to enact. Before doing that, however, let me begin by explaining why the prevailing terminology of procedural and substantive due process is unhelpful and potentially misleading. The first thing to note is that although they are commonly called the due process clauses, these clauses actually have four operative words, not two. It would actually be better to call them the due process of law clauses. I think we can afford to add the two words to the label for the clause, the due process of law clauses. The original meaning of the first two words, due process, specifies a requirement of a judicial proceeding of some kind prior to any deprivations of life, liberty, or property. You just heard that from Professor Harrison. On this, all who have studied the meaning of the term agree. It's about what judges should be doing. What they disagree about is the scope of this judicial inquiry, not whether a judicial inquiry is required. The last two words, of law, clarifies this by connoting that a statute purporting to justify a deprivation of life, liberty, or property must be a valid law, which is within the constitutional power of the respective legislature to enact. Once it is acknowledged that the procedure or process which the due process of law clauses guarantee includes an opportunity to challenge the content or substance of a statute for its conformity with the Constitution, and that a statute which does not conform with the Constitution is not a constitutionally proper law, the utility of the distinction between substantive and procedural due process vanishes. Consider Commerce Clause, what we call Commerce Clause challenges to legislation. We readily accept the fact that the due process of law provides a judicial forum to contest whether the substance of a federal statute exceeds Congress's powers under the Commerce and Necessary and Proper Clauses. If it does, such a statute cannot be used to deprive someone of life, liberty, or property because it is not a constitutionally valid law. As Chief Justice John Marshall stated in McCulloch v. Maryland, should Congress, under the pretext of executing its powers, pass laws for the accomplishment of objects not entrusted to the government, it would become the painful duty of this tribunal, should a case requiring such a decision come before it, to say that such an act was not the law of the land. And this distinction between act and law is replete in founding era sources and 19th century era sources. In other words, an unconstitutional statute is a mere legislative act rather than a binding law. Despite the role it is playing in providing a judicial forum, the Fifth Amendment's due process of law clauses disappears in such cases. And we speak only of the Commerce Clause. Same thing with First Amendment challenges. In sum, the core question in every case involving a purported deprivation of life, liberty, or property without due process of law is whether the person accused was guilty of violating a statute that was within the power of a legislature to enact. Answering this question always requires a judicial process by which the guilt or innocence of an accused is determined by a fair procedure. But it sometimes also requires an opportunity to challenge before a neutral tribunal whether the substance of a statute conflicts with the requirements of the higher law of the U.S. Constitution or with the Constitution of a state. In other words, sometimes the due process of law requires a judicial procedure designed to ensure that the substance of a statute conforms with the higher law of the land before any person can be deprived of their life, liberty, or property. The appropriate label for this process is not substantive due process. The appropriate label is the due process of law, which happens to be what the text says, twice. The distinction between substantive and procedural due process is simply unhelpful. With this semantic critique of substantive due process out of the way, let me now turn to the original meaning of the term due process of law. at the time of the founding and at the time of the 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868. While some originalists used to insist that a statute satisfied the due process of law if it simply received the requisite vote in the legislature, there's a growing consensus that historically it sometimes required an inquiry into the substance of the law as well. You just heard one such inquiry from Professor Harrison about whether it was genuinely a legislative act as opposed to a judicial act. That requires an inquiry into the substance of the law to figure that out. We've already seen in my earlier remarks how the due process of law authorizes a judicial assessment of whether a statute has exceeded the enumerated powers of Congress, the commerce power, the necessary and proper clause. And I think this cannot be contested. There is also a consensus that a judicial inquiry is required when an act of Congress, quote, appears on its face to be within a specific prohibition of the Constitution, such as those of the first 10 amendments, unquote, as was famously affirmed in footnote 4 of United States versus Caroline Products. And most originalists today, even Senator Josh Hawley, would also accept that most of these same guarantees are enforceable, these same prohibitions are enforceable against the states via the due process of law clauses of the 14th Amendment. He was just quoted as saying, oh yeah, well, that's incorporation. Well, incorporation is a substantive due process inquiry. Probably shouldn't be. It really should be a privileges or immunities clause inquiry, but that's what we currently have, and he endorsed it. The controversy surrounding modern substantive due process doctrine, therefore, concerns whether the due process of law also entails a judicial scrutiny of legislation that may infringe on an unenumerated right, such as, for example, a right of privacy that was protected in Griswold versus Connecticut, or the freedom of contract that was protected in Lochner v. New York. But while these cases did protect liberties not enumerated in the Constitution, what I've said so far suggests that this is not the most illuminating way to frame the issue in either of those two cases. The relevant issue is whether a law prohibiting bake shop employees from working more than 60 hours a week, or a law prohibiting a married couple from using contraception is within the competence of state legislatures to enact. To address that question, one needs a theory of what legislatures are competent to do. One needs a theory of the police power of states. Just as the Fifth Amendment's due process of law clause requires a judicial process to determine whether the substance of an act of Congress is calculated to carry into effect an enumerated power, the due process of law clause in the 14th Amendment imposes limits on the ends which state legislatures may pursue. It is not enough that a state constitution authorizes a particular exercise of power. Such acts must also be consistent with Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, which stipulates that no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. Obviously, if just passing a state constitutional measure was enough to satisfy that, then that provision would have no bite whatsoever. After the amendment was ratified in 1868, immediately after, courts constructed a doctrine known as the Police Powers Doctrine to identify the scope of state legislative power. In his influential treatise on the constitutional limitations which rest upon the legislative power of the United States of the American Union, published in 1868, Thomas McIntyre Cooley, the Chief Justice of the Michigan Supreme Court and a professor at the University of Michigan Law School, as well as its dean, formulated the question confronting judges in any case involving a purported exercise of the police power as follows, quote, whether the state exceeds its just powers in dealing with the property and restraining the actions of individuals. And notice the phrase just powers, the same phrase that's used in the Declaration of Independence, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. What are those just powers? Cooley articulated this construction of a police power, quote, the police of a state embraces its system of internal regulation by which it sought not only to preserve the public peace, public order, and to prevent offenses against the state, but also to establish for the intercourse of citizen with citizen those rules of good manners and good neighborhood which are calculated to prevent a conflict of rights and to ensure to each the uninterrupted enjoyment of his own so far as is reasonably consistent with the like enjoyment of the rights of others. Cooley made no effort to create a comprehensive list of proper state powers, believing that one could not enumerate, quote, all of the various cases in which the exercise by one individual of his rights may conflict with similar exercises by others. Instead, he focused on whether the state's actions were calculated to safeguard the rights of individuals. Consider the 1885 case of In re Jacobs. In this case, the New York Court of Appeals, its highest court, invalidated a ban on tenement cigar making after determining that it was, quote, not a health law, unquote, and that, quote, it had no relation whatever to public health. That the court regarded the ban as pretextual legislation can be gleaned from its declaration that, quote, under the mere guise of police regulations, personal rights and private property cannot be arbitrarily invaded. And its citation then to Chief Justice Marshall's language concerning pretext in McCulloch. Therefore, to give effect to the letter of the 14th Amendment's due process of law clause, we need an approach to adjudication by which federal and state judges can effectuate both the letter and the original spirit of the 14th Amendment by realistically assessing whether a state legislature has exercised their police powers in good faith. Such an approach would examine not evidence of legislators' subjective motivations, but the degree of fit between the means they adopted and a constitutionally permissible end. But what are the constitutionally permissible ends of government? I don't have time to provide an answer in the minutes that I have here. Evan Burnick and I examined it at length in our forthcoming article in the William and Mary Law Review, and so you can read it there, or you can read an advanced copy on SSRN, which is currently available. It's called No Arbitrary Power. So let me merely observe that there is a universal consensus, both that state legislative power can be used to punish rights violations after they have occurred, and that the police power allows for the regulation of behavior that risks violating the rights of others to prevent rights violations from occurring. This latter type of regulation falls under the traditional rubric of regulations to protect the health and safety of the public. In addition, some authorities also included a third object of this end of legislation, the protection of the public morals. But the meaning of this term, public morals, is ambiguous. Some such laws would clearly be warranted under the rights protective conception of the police power, laws that regulate conduct in the public sphere, that is, areas under the control of the government to which the general public has access, like streets, sidewalks, alleyways, and public parks. The legislature has a fiduciary duty to manage behavior that occurs in these spaces in a manner that facilitates its use by the general public, which has a right to use them, and that general public includes parents and their children. All of these exercises of the state police power were generally accepted in 1868 and remain so today. This leaves us with one last claim of a police power end that is in dispute: whether states may prohibit conduct performed in private and outside the view of the general public on the sole ground, not that because it violates the rights of anyone in particular or threatens to violate the rights of anyone in particular, but solely on the ground that the legislature deems such conduct to be immoral. Addressing the merits of this contested morals prong of the police power, at least at length, is simply not possible in the time I have remaining. But let me just offer three brief observations before I close. First, regardless of the view one takes on this issue that we disagree about, people of diverse first-order political philosophical views can agree that the rest of the legislative ends I've just discussed, that is, protecting public health and safety and regulating conduct in public places so as to minimize rights conflicts, are perfectly proper ends of state government. So nothing prevents courts from using these ends in a means-ends analysis to identify arbitrary legislative acts that are not really in pursuit of those ends. Second, a power to regulate or prohibit private conduct outside of spaces controlled by the government solely on the basis that it is immoral is not contained anywhere in the text of the Constitution, either expressly or by implication. If such a power it exists because judges say it exists. Now, that is not a deal breaker for me. Just because something's not enumerated doesn't mean it's not real. But it is a deal breaker for some people who use that type of argument against protecting, for example, unenumerated rights because they're unenumerated. Well, so is this power. It's unenumerated. Third, in our article, Evan Burnick and I maintain that the original spirit of the due process of law clauses was to bar the arbitrary exercise of government power. If that's our standard, then I doubt that the regulation of purely private acts, solely on the basis of their alleged immorality, can be non-arbitrary in practice. But I'm going to leave a discussion of that to the Q&A. I'm going to close now by identifying a standard that all laws depriving any person of life, liberty, or property must satisfy to satisfy the due process of law. Such a law, and wait for this, and actually you can use this one on your exam, such a law must be rationally related to a legitimate or proper end of government. Such a law must be rationally related to a legitimate or proper end of government. Now, most of you will recognize this as what is called the rational basis test. And you'd be right. The standard I'm proposing actually purports to be present-day doctrine. That's how radical I am. I'm in favor of the status quo, sort of. Unfortunately, since the 1955 Warren Court case, and I stress it was a Warren Court case, not even a New Deal case, of Williamson v. Lee Optical, unless a law is violating a judicially privileged fundamental right or discriminating against a judicially privileged suspect class, such laws will be upheld if a judge can imagine any conceivable reason why a legislature might have enacted it. Conceivable basis review of this type is an abdication of the judicial duty to ensure that no person be deprived of their life, liberty, or property except by a valid exercise of a legitimate or proper state end. By substituting a formalist conceivable basis review from a realistic assessment of whether a law is irrational or arbitrary, modern-day judges are failing to do their duty as required by the original meaning of the due process of law. Thank you.
Hi, so I'm the practitioner on the panel, so I'm going to make a practical observation and then tell a war story. The practical observation is, I think what I just heard is, you know, oversimplified, certainly, is that the debate about whether there is such a thing as substantive due process is asking the wrong question, right? That no, there probably isn't. But that doesn't mean there aren't substantive limitations imposed by the Constitution or external law on the content of legislation. They just don't come directly from the Due Process Clause. They come from the Vested Rights Doctrine or from inherent limits on the scope of the police power or from some other location. If that's right, then I'm going to suggest that to those of you who have sort of originalist and conservative constitutional impulses, you have a bit of a practical decision to make about the sort of purity of your constitutional interpretation and the practical results of what our constitutional regime actually looks like. Because, of course, we all know that there are all sorts of places where the originalist vision of the actual limitations on the scope of legislative power has fallen away. Most notably, the original limitations on the scope of Congress's power under the Commerce Clause, right? No one in the 1790s would have remotely recognized what we now think of as the commerce power. And there are a lot of other examples. Against that backdrop, if you were going to forswear the one avenue by which modern Supreme Court doctrine permits meaningful limitations on the substance of legislation as, you know, inconsistent with a pure conception of the original intent, you are accepting that there can be no movement back toward what the practical originalist conception of constitutional power was, right? So you might take seriously the possibility of using the tools at hand to move constitutional law back in a more originalist direction. Substantive due process is one of the tools at hand. So if one had a desire to articulate and pursue a more originalist, more conservative vision of what substantive due process review might look like. I'm going to propose that that I have a case that you might find interesting, that Judge Griffith and I worked on together years ago, in a way, called Abigail Alliance versus von Eschenbach. This case has the sort of distinction of, I think, being the only economic substantive due process case in modern times to get very far and to attract the support of the Wall Street Journal editorial page. So this is a conservative substantive due process claim. The substantive policy that we were seeking was actually enacted into law by the Republican Congress and signed by President Trump last year. So, you know, this is not what you ordinarily think of as a liberal crusade, right? The claim was that terminally ill patients who have exhausted all of their approved treatment options ought to have the right to bargain with drug companies for drugs that are currently in substantial human clinical trials, if the drug company is willing to supply the drug, free from FDA interference. The case is inspired by a young woman, Abigail Burroughs, who was actually a third-year undergrad here at UVA when she died of cancer. Abigail's cancer was in her neck, but it was actually a colon cancer, where the receptors on the cells were of the sort that ordinarily derive from colon cancer. She exhausted all of the approved treatment options that she had. It is in the nature of cancer that it adapts, right? So you try things, and then they work for a while, and then they stop working because the cancer evolves. She ran out of all of the treatments. Her oncologist at Johns Hopkins thought that her best bet to survive longer was a drug called Erbitux, which was then in clinical trials. But the hitch was that although Erbitux was a modern targeted therapy targeted directly at the receptors on her cells, the clinical trial was limited to colon cancer patients because that's the market, right? Colon cancer is an awful lot more widespread than head and neck cancer that happens to look a little bit like colon cancer. And as a consequence, Abigail couldn't get into the trial and she died. Our claim, as I said, was that if you are terminally ill and you've exhausted your approved treatment options and there's something that your doctor thinks would help you that is in substantial human clinical trials, but you can't get into the trial, then you should be allowed to make the same risk-benefit decision that the people who are in the trial are making, right? This was an economic substantive due process claim because it was very important to the claim that we wanted a right to pay money for the drug, which the FDA forbids. And, you know, the basic point was that if the government concedes that it's ethical to test this drug in human beings and if the people in the trial can give informed consent, then what business does the government have saying that you can't bargain with the drug company to try and get access? At a minimum, if the government wants to stand in your way in that circumstance, we argued, the burden of justification ought to be something higher than what we call rational basis review, particularly Williamson versus Lee Optical rational basis review. I'm going to submit that this was a serious claim, both on originalist and non-originalist grounds. There is quite a serious historical argument that self-defense ought to be considered a fundamental right in constitutional terms. At least the Sixth Circuit has held so. The Seventh Circuit has held that the Due Process Clause constitutionalizes the tort of interference with rescue, which was a common law tort that if you got in the way of a third party trying to help save somebody's life, then that was tortious. And the Seventh Circuit has recognized a constitutional claim in those circumstances if it's a state actor. The framers called self-defense the first law of nature. And, you know, I think there's a serious claim that if a state tried to get rid of it and say that you didn't have a right to defend your life, that that would be a violation of substantive due process. And if you have a fundamental right to protect yourself with deadly force against a human attacker, you know, why not a cancer cell? And of course, the 18th and 19th century history of the regulation of medicine was extraordinarily laissez-faire. It's not hard to find old treatises about the scope of the police power that say that the state has no power under the police power over any system of medicine, as long as it's not a quack and as long as the state isn't trying to protect people from someone who will actively harm them, if reasonable doctors could disagree, it exceeds the scope of the police power for the state to interfere. And in terms of the Supreme Court's more recent jurisprudence, for those of you who don't have originalist inclinations, the court has already recognized that there is a fundamental right to trust your own doctor's responsible medical judgment about what is or is not necessary to save your life, even in circumstances where the state formally disagrees as embodied in legislation. If, but only if, I guess, the treatment in question happens to be an abortion. It can't possibly be the law that you have a fundamental right to trust your own doctor's responsible medical judgment about a treatment necessary to save your life only if that judgment involves the incidental destruction of a human fetus. It just doesn't make any sense at all, right? So this is a serious claim. A panel of the D.C. Circuit initially accepted it 2-1. Then the D.C. Circuit took it up in bank and rejected the claim 10-2, I think, proving once and for all that panel selection is a critically important aspect of appellate advocacy. But the reasons, the debate that we had and the reasons that the D.C. Circuit gave for rejecting the claim, I'm going to submit, illustrate a handful of sort of interesting things to think about if you were trying to pursue a project of a more conservative, more originalist vision of unenumerated rights. First and foremost, substantive due process as practiced in the courts practically today has become actively allergic to history, or at least to any history that predates the New Deal. That's in part because of the shadow of Lochner, and in part because of just a general sense that conditions were so different in the 19th century that nothing that they thought really informs in a meaningful way, you know, what the scope of regulation should look like today. Randy will remember that in Raich versus Gonzalez, the Ninth Circuit actually said that the Supreme Court's decision in Lawrence versus Texas means that only the recent trend of the last several decades is relevant to a sort of historical understanding of rights. In Abigail Alliance, the D.C. Circuit said that the lack of drug regulation in the 19th century was most likely a product of the limited science of the day rather than any, you know, vision about what the rights of patients were. You know, if that's the sort of view you're going to take of the pre-New Deal history, that none of it is relevant, then, you know, you probably just ought to conclude that the due process has nothing for you if you have originalist or conservative implications, because self-evidently there aren't going to be any new rights grounded in historical libertarian tradition if the only history that anybody is willing to listen to is the post-New Deal history of the ever-expanding and encroaching nanny state, right? Second, and relatedly, you have to figure out what you think about what I'll call the tradition of non-regulation problem. So the reality is that most of the things that someone with originalist impulses would want to say are protected against state, implicitly protected against state encroachment, are things that no legislature in the 19th century ever thought about infringing on, at least not until the Progressive Era. Nobody in the 1820s or the 1880s was telling doctors and patients that they couldn't use their own judgment about medical treatment unless they satisfied some bureaucrats in Washington, D.C., right? And as a consequence, if you go looking, you're never going to find a judicial opinion that says that this attempted encroachment by Congress upon the autonomy of doctors and patients is inconsistent with the implicit limits on the police power or whatnot, because it just never came up. It was never tried. This is a serious problem for, you know, any kind of originalist conception of how you think about unenumerated rights. You know, on the one hand, you can't say that substantive due process or any analog in the Privileges and Immunities Clause or anything else, you know, freezes into place the full scope of 19th century laissez-faire. There really were a lot of things that they didn't regulate in the 19th century because it just wasn't necessary, the problem hadn't arisen, maybe the science necessary to regulate wasn't available. You have to try to identify that subset of things that government didn't do because it would have been regarded as an unacceptable intrusion on individual liberty. And judicial opinions aren't going to get you there. If that's the criteria that you insist upon finding, you know, in most circumstances, you're not going to find it. What are you going to find? Well, you're going to find, you know, Christopher Tiedemann's or Cooley's treatise on the limits of the police power. You're going to find, you know, John Stuart Mill's harm principle, which some people but not others would have endorsed back then. Second, you've got to get rid of this Washington versus Glucksberg nonsense, and particularly the careful description part of the Washington versus Glucksberg test, right? So Glucksberg says that in order to identify a new unenumerated right, you have to describe it carefully, and then you have to look at whether it's grounded in historical tradition and whether it's implicit in the concept of ordered liberty. This conception, well, that rights have to be described at the narrowest possible level of generality. I mean, first and foremost, I hope everybody recognizes at this point that if you have an originalist mindset, you know, wedding yourself to this idea is just unilateral disarmament, because nobody on the liberal side of the substantive due process debate gives a hoot about Washington versus Glucksberg at this point, right? I mean, it's not even cited in Lawrence and Obergefell. The Glucksberg requirement that new rights claims, even if they're really old rights claims, like we thought ours was, have to be framed in the narrowest possible way, it creates this impossible catch-22 for litigants. In Abigail Alliance, we dutifully describe the right, you know, the narrowest possible way: terminally ill patients, no treatment options, drug in phase two trials, whatnot. And you know, we got killed for it, in part because once you get done describing a right that carefully and narrowly, it doesn't seem fundamental anymore, right? It's easy for courts to make fun of it and say, this doesn't seem like a fundamental right. It seems like you're trying to tweak the details of a modern regulatory scheme via the Constitution. You know, I thought fundamental rights were things like life and liberty and, you know, maybe privacy. So maybe we should have just talked about self-defense or maybe the right to life in Abigail Alliance. Maybe that would have worked better. The other problem with the careful description requirement is that it wrongfully focuses the courts on just looking for traditions at the most specific possible level of generality, which, as I said earlier, isn't going to exist, right? We can't point to a tradition protecting a right to take drugs that are in phase two trials if you're terminally ill, because there was no such thing as the modern clinical trial system until the FDCA amendments in the 1960s. Justice Scalia's point in footnote 6 in Michael H. Versus Gerald D., and then Rehnquist's point in Washington versus Glucksberg, I think, was, or at least the part of it that makes sense, is that if you look at the narrowest definition of the right that you're claiming, and you find at that narrowest level of generality a tradition of active prohibition, right, if the thing you were claiming was criminalized at common law, then, you know, you really should be out of court. And that, you know, that makes some sense. But if you look at the narrowest level of generality and you can't find anything, if there's no tradition of protection but no tradition of criminalization either, you know, you're supposed to then be able to back up and argue from broader premises, right? If the D.C. Circuit in Abigail Alliance says that there does not appear to us to have been a tradition of protecting the right to self-defense by means that haven't been proven effective. Well, maybe not, but there's no tradition of criminalizing self-defense efforts by ineffective means either. And, you know, you're supposed to be able to back up and talk about self-defense generally and the right to life generally. You have to recognize that in Michael H. and in Washington versus Glucksberg, Rehnquist and Scalia were not trying to articulate an originalist vision for substantive due process. They were trying to kill the endeavor, right? Their objective was not originalism, it was majoritarianism. It was to, and Justice Scalia was quite forthright about this, right? It was to articulate a vision of constitutional law under which judicial power would be maximally constrained. And, you know, if that's your objective, then that's your objective. But it's not the same thing as originalism, right? And finally, the last thing I'll say is that we have to banish this misconception that is rooted in the shadow of Lochner, I think, that anything you can describe as regulating an economic transaction is thereby, you know, the same thing as the maximum hours law at issue in Lochner versus New York. You know, one of the most distressing things to me about the whole Abigail Alliance debate at the time was how hard it was for people on both sides of that debate, you know, to grasp the fact that we weren't asking that the drug companies be forced to do anything, and also that it was important to the right we were claiming that we'd be able to pay them. Because the way that you exercise liberty in a free society is by paying people to help you. And if you can't pay people to help you, then, you know, liberty often isn't worth very much. Whatever the constitutional line you want to draw is between, you know, economic regulation, which gets more deference, and non-economic regulation, it can't just be that anytime you want to pay somebody to help you, that means that all bets are off and the legislature can do anything it wants.
Thank you. Thank you, Scott. Thank you, Randy. And John, my comments this morning are going to build off of Scott's. I am most concerned with the future of the Due Process Clause in the sphere of constitutional protections of property rights and economic liberties. I will be as brief as possible to allow time for Q&A, as I realize the time may be running a little bit short. In my judgment, the importance of the Due Process Clause in this area is likely to increase in coming years, particularly with respect to disputes over civil forfeiture and occupational licensing. That said, I do acknowledge that the increased importance of the Due Process Clause is not an inevitability for reasons that I think were just illustrated by Scott's comments. In order to have the Due Process Clause play a more prominent role, this will require an extraordinary amount of effort by very skilled litigants, and it will also require not judicial restraint, but also, looking forward to the subject of our coming smackdown debate on judicial engagement versus judicial restraint, I think it will require judicial engagement, and judicial engagement of a very, very hard kind. So let me say a few words about why I suspect that it is the case that the Due Process Clause is going to grow in importance, and where I think some of the pitfalls are. So first, why do I think this is the case? Because in a nutshell, the Due Process Clause is a highly promising constitutional vehicle for addressing early 21st century problems. And nowhere is this more apparent than in civil forfeiture and occupational licensing, two areas where large chunks of the electorate on both left and right, as those are currently defined in our political debate, see government behaving in a way that is cronyist, that is not for the general welfare, that in no way, shape, or form looks like something that is rationally related to a legitimate or proper end of government, but instead looks like something where the strong are in effect able to beat up on the weak by taking their stuff or by preventing them from pursuing lawful occupations. We are living in an era of grave concerns about the expansion of the regulatory state, concerns that encompass distrust of elites and dissatisfaction with restrictions on economic opportunity. Now, the Hornbook answer to those who seek to challenge legislative and administrative measures on the grounds of impairment of their constitutional rights to acquire, possess, or retain property, or to pursue a trade, or to decide whether or not to participate in markets, is, in effect, pound sand, at least when it comes to the courts. Your remedy doesn't lie with judges. Your remedy, if you're unhappy about what you see as infringements on property rights or economic liberty, you have to go and persuade the political branches to agree with you, not persuade courts interpreting the Constitution that the government has overstepped its bounds. This formulation is often referred to as the New Deal settlement, a reference to the standard narrative that, as leading constitutional law scholar Erwin Chemerinsky puts it in the most recent edition of his constitutional law textbook, after 1937, the Supreme Court, quote, adopted a policy of great deference to economic regulations. That means great that great deference means that the proper judicial role is to step aside, in the words of Harvard Law professor Frank Michelman, and allow the legislative and administrative components of government to determine the scope of property rights and economic liberties. Now, this is as good a time as any for me to repeat to first year's John Harrison's warning about not taking what I say into your constitutional law exam, because I do want to emphasize that I am the outlier in this area, not Professors Chemerinsky or Michelman. Nevertheless, we have seen something that I believe is very interesting, and here is where I disagree with Professor Barnett, although I agree with you on many, many things. I think that this New Deal settlement is far less stable than Professor Barnett seems to think, for the following reasons: that in recent years, significant fissures have appeared. Not so much in cases involving the Due Process Clause, I want to stress. In fact, I think it is the absence of a well-developed jurisprudence under the Due Process Clause that has led to a lot of what we have seen. Simply put, what we have seen over the last couple of decades, and getting, I would say, more intense, is that constitutional claims, claims of infringements of property rights and economic liberty, are, of course, phrased as not due process claims, although they sometimes are, but litigants work very hard to phrase them as something else, in particular to phrase them as First Amendment cases. So in the area of occupational licensing, what we have seen are a lot of cases brought arguing not just due process, but also First Amendment, and sometimes litigants win. When they win, of course, they tend to win on First Amendment grounds. But it's not just occupational licensing harnessing the First Amendment. We've also seen, I would argue anyway, some significant movement in the area of eminent domain. It is true that the complaining property owners lost in Kelo. It was deemed by the Supreme Court, but by 5-4, that the taking of their property had indeed been for public use. But note again that what was really at issue in this case, or one of the things that was most important in this case, was not so much the definition of public use, whether the property that was taken was actually going to be used by the public or whether it actually was going to be owned by the government, and so on and so forth. The complaints at their heart, the complaints of the property owners in Kelo, were complaints of exactly the sort that Professors Harrison and Barnett were just discussing, that in effect the property owners believed that what had been done was illegitimate and beyond, not rationally related to a laudable or permissible goal of government. Now, going forward, I think there are formidable challenges for those who would use the Due Process Clause, and that is because the living Constitution is a very attractive means of going about things, because it sounds like it's going to adjust to, it's simply adjusting to circumstances. Originalism has received powerful challenges from advocates of living constitutionalism on two important grounds. First, that originalism does not provide a methodology pursuant to which constitutional law can adjust to changing circumstances. And second, that originalism is an unmoored and, in effect, unaccountable sort of methodology, one that in effect gets to make up its own rules as it goes along. Now, I think that those who seek to harness the originalist vision and use the Due Process Clause to address 21st century problems can do so. And I think that Scott Ballinger just provided an excellent model of how skilled litigators who want to engage in this go about doing so. But I would not for one moment wish us to underestimate the difficulty of this challenge. There has to be, I think, very serious and significant historical research. And in particular, the question has to be answered. How do we translate practices of two centuries ago? In civil forfeiture, I think this problem is especially apparent. How do we translate practices of two centuries ago, which may look very different? For example, seizing ships that were used in some kind of piracy. How do we translate this to today's practices? So again, I believe that this can be done, and I suspect it will be done. But it will not be done overnight, and it will require, I think, active judicial engagement along with the concerted efforts of a number of very sensible litigators and serious scholars who are committed to doing careful research and making careful arguments. Thank you.
Okay, well, we're short on time, but we do have a few minutes for questions. Yes.
I had a question for, I had a question for Professor Harrison, and I think Professor Barnett could also answer this as well. So you may be familiar with this case from the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. It's Sharpless versus Mayor and City of Philadelphia. Either of you heard of this case? So I ask out of curiosity because in that case, the Chief Justice Jeremiah Black, who I know you're familiar with, yeah, it's a case about incorporation of a railroad and using bonds to pay for it. But I don't really want to get into that part. What Justice Black says is that outside the limitations of the Constitution and the legislative powers given to Congress, beyond this there lies a vast field of power granted to the legislator by the general words of the Constitution and not reserved, prohibited, or given away to others. Of this field, the General Assembly is entitled to the full and uncontrolled possession. Their use of it can be limited only by their own discretion. To me, it is plain that the General Assembly may exercise all powers which are properly legislative and are which not taken away by our own or the federal Constitution, as it is that the people have all rights which are expressly reserved. He said that the court could not overturn a law because it was void, because it violated the spirits of our institution or impaired any of those rights, which is the object of free government to protect. So I bring this up just to say that I'm just curious how that might operate with these pre-1866 or 1868 conceptions of vested rights theory. I'm just wondering if that sort of presses actually closer to parliamentary supremacy, although Black is clear that he doesn't mean that that's actually what's translated to the state government.
There are a lot of statements that sound like that, that come from that era, including statements by Cooley that sound like that. So it's all in the qualifiers. Legislatures may exercise their legislative power to the utmost. Then the question is, what is the scope of their legislative power? And that issue only became pertinent at the federal level. It previously had been pertinent at the state level, and there are state cases which deal with that. This only became pertinent at the federal level once there was a federal constraint on state lawmaking power that came in the 14th Amendment in the form of the Privileges or Immunities Clause, which Jerry Black did his best to excise from the Constitution, since he was one of the lawyers who argued against applying the 14th Amendment to protect the butchers in New Orleans in the slaughterhouse cases. And his express goal was to undercut and to destroy Reconstruction in the course of doing that. Of course, he was opposed by John Campbell on the other side, whose goal was to use the 14th Amendment to destroy Reconstruction. So he basically had racists on both sides of that case. That was Jerry Black's vision, and he actually was successfully implementing it in other litigation that he initiated, as I guess you must know.
I'm going to use that as the opportunity to say something I wanted to say anyway, like a good law professor, which is to try to identify what I think is the difference between Randy and me. Randy said at one point that the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment imposes certain limits, the kind of limits that Justice and Attorney General Black was calling into question there. My view is it incorporates them by reference, to put it briefly. That is to say, their content is found elsewhere. That's why I said it points to them. So my response to Black's opinion there is, the question whether that's right is an important one, an important question of Pennsylvania and conceivably federal constitutional law that the 14th Amendment does not resolve precisely because it points to but does not contain those principles.
Professor, though, the harder question, I think, is what the student is getting at here, which is that the scope of unenumerated rights is in direct proportion to the scope of the plenary legislative power at the state level. And that's often the pressure point doctrinally as we're working through these problems in actual cases on the bench. First and foremost, there's the Glucksberg problem. It's the gateway to heightened scrutiny, which has to pass through Glucksberg, and that rests heavily on history and tradition. But so does the question, if you can't pass through the Glucksberg gateway and we're in rational basis land, and let's set aside fake rational basis of the Lee optical kind and talk about meaningful rational basis, how do we work through the problem of the traditional scope of the plenary legislative power at the state level, which is different from limited congressional power, or what used to be limited congressional power based on Article 1, Section 8 limitations. State legislatures have plenary power.
They have plenary power, though, does not mean absolute power. It does not mean the power to do anything they will. That is tyrannical power, and it's not something that is antithetical to republicanism and republican form of government. So whatever legislative power is, it's a limited power, and in the most abstract way, it is a non-arbitrary power, which means it has to be supported by adequate, acceptable reasons. And then you have to ask, what are the acceptable reasons for which this legislation was enacted? And then you get into the need, not for a theory of rights, but for a theory of power. So you're re-putting the question that I put in my talk, which is not the kind of thing that I can produce here, other than to allude to the historic approach, which is that this power embraced the protection of the health and safety of the public, as well as the protection of the public morals, and then we can have a debate about what the scope of the public morals prong of that is, and whether that includes the regulation of purely private activities solely on the grounds that the legislature deems it to be immoral, which I think is not a power they can exercise non-arbitrarily. So as long as we're talking about a health and safety law, I think we are within the appropriate scope, or what you call the plenary scope, of legislative power. But we all know, and this is the key to what Julia is telling us, is that many laws are enacted ostensibly as health and safety laws, but not actually as health and safety laws. They're there for protectionist reasons. They're there to help certain groups out at the expense of others. And it is a judge's duty to examine whether a particular act of the legislature fits the end closely enough to be a health and safety law, or actually is meant for other motives, which was the word the court in Lochner used, which is why they got the maximum hours law into the Bake Shop Act. The last thing I'll just say about this is, look, the Bake Shop Act in the terrible, awful Lochner case was quoted in its entirety and upheld by the Lochner Court. It was an elaborate health and safety law governing the bake shop industry. Only one provision was called into question, the maximum hours law, because the court could not find a sufficient connection between that and health and safety, and they perfectly well knew that that provision got into the law for other reasons than health and safety.
Anybody else with a response? Okay, I think we're wrapping up and going to lunch. Thank you all for your attention.
Let's thank you.